This is Kevin Van Hentenrick, and you're listening to WithoutYourHead.com. And if you lift the lid of the basket, you die.
Welcome to the Station of Decapitation Without Your Head. I'm Nasty Neil.
I'm Treacherous Trista.
And we're joined by Gio Parsons, writer of Willy's Wonderland. It's very cool
to have you here. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for having me today. This is awesome.
Yeah. So, Willy's Wonderland, how long have you had the idea for the movie?
It's been in gestation, I think, since 2012. I had done plays around the turn of the decade was that, or the turn of, yeah, 2010s was like the height of when I was doing my plays. And after one of the plays, a friend came up to me and he was like, it doesn't matter like how much you keep doing these plays, they only exist as long as the play is going. So if you want to further your career, you're going to have to make a movie. And so that was kind of the genesis of everything. I was like, okay, I gotta come up with a movie. And I'm a big fan of horror movies. I'm a big fan of like B movies, especially the ones that you'd find in a Blockbuster video back in the 80s and in the 90s when I was haunting them. And so I thought to myself, it would be really fantastic if I could create the ultimate B horror movie. So that was kind of like, that was the whole genesis of it, so long ago.
Were the plays horror related or B movie related? Or
they were always absurd. So they would always fit in the world of Willy's Wonderland. Some of them were horror related. I remember we did this one. It was like a couple of the things that I really like to do with plays was shock the audience. And I remember I've done it twice really well, but the best time I think was we did a set change. And when we did the set change, I put my friend behind a curtain and I like walked it out and draped it over a couch and he hid behind the couch. And then we did this scene that goes on for about 10 minutes, me and another actress. And the audience is almost lulled into just watching the scene. And then he's supposedly dead in the play. All of a sudden, he just jumps up from behind the couch. You know, nobody saw it coming. Nobody realized it was going to happen. And there was this scream from the audience that just like reverberated throughout the whole entire theater and probably outside, like something that you'd only see in Monsters, Inc. that would just, you know, blow the containers off their tops. So that was what I always liked to do, was just shock people, but in a fun way.
So when you go from writing plays to writing a screenplay for a film, like, what are the differences?
Well, that's one of the reasons that Willy's Wonderland takes place in one location, is because I was so used to doing things in one area, just on a stage, that I figured, well, one, I'm already used to driving a story that way, and two, it wouldn't allow me to cheat. So there's a lot of differences, like when you're writing a movie. And if you're writing a movie, you can be in outer space, and the next scene you can be underwater, and the next scene you can be on the sun. You know, you can do whatever you want in a film, but if you're writing a play, you have to stay where you are. So when I started writing Willy's Wonderland, I always had the intention of just shooting it myself in a friend's garage. So I always wanted to keep it in one location to keep the cost down and to be able to actually, like, facilitate making the movie.
So you started writing in 2012, you said. Like, when did it get finished, the screenplay get finished and start to become, you know, talked about to become a movie?
Yeah, so I think it was around 2012 when I started, and I was writing different things, and different plays were still going on at the time, and it had fallen a little bit by the wayside. Like, I had just tried to get it out to people and wasn't really working as hard as I could on it, and was focusing more on an acting career. And my uncle called me up, I think this was probably around 2015, and he really kicked me in the butt and said, hey, man, you got to make this thing. Do it yourself with your camcorder if you have to. So you got to make it. So that's when I started to really put it into full gear. I did like a Indiegogo to try and raise money to shoot the movie. It didn't really hit its goal, but I got enough to shoot a scene. I went out and I shot a scene in a garage. It's that scene that where the janitor's cleaning up and Ozzy shows up and just pummels them. I had shot that scene, and I started sending that out to people. I started sending the script out just to anybody I could think of in the industry. And all that hard work and all that rejection, it was noticed by a couple of people. A lady named Kaylee Marsh put it on the Blood List, which is like best horror scripts that haven't been made. So they started to get some attention there. And then a casting director named Venus Kanani, who was friends with Nicolas Cage's manager, she took note of the script and she gave it to him and like pitched it to him and was like, hey, this is, she said to me, she's like, I know you want to do this for your own selfish goods, but she's like, if you got it to somebody of some weight, especially Nicolas Cage, it could really be something special. And she's the one that knocked on his door and got his attention and got Mike to read it. And then Mike is the person that loved the script and ended up producing it and then went and gave it to Nicolas Cage.
Wow. I mean, something that you were thinking about recording with a camcorder, then it goes on to you get Nicolas Cage as a lead. That's a, you know, pretty big jump.
It is a huge jump. And that's one of the things, is like, people talk about, well, why doesn't the janitor say anything? Well, because I thought I was going to be doing it with the camcorder, and I thought I was going to have to be setting the camera up over here and over there. And I didn't think I would have time to have dialogue or go back and rewatch the dialogue. There was only so many things that I thought I was capable of in that moment. And having a thing where I talked all the time wasn't going to be it. So I just made the character silent. He's not mute. He can talk. He just doesn't have anything to say. But it just adds to the aura around Willy's Wonderland. And I think it really worked, especially with Nick doing it, because he brought so much life to that character with just an eyebrow raise or a smirk or a smile or a frown. It's amazing how talented the man is. He can carry a whole movie for 90 minutes without even saying one word.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, really, I think that's pretty cool of Nicolas Cage, too, to do a movie without dialogue. Because, you know, he's Nicolas Cage, a big star. Maybe he's like, well, I'm not going to do a movie where I don't actually talk in it for 90 minutes.
Well, I think there's two things with that. Is number one, he wanted that challenge, definitely, because he had done, 98 movies prior to this where he was famous for his monologues, or he's famous for his dialogues, or just going off or destroying a pool table while singing Hokey Pokey. You know, he was famous for that. And this presented a different kind of challenge. And as an actor, I think that he saw it as a chance that he probably would never get again. I mean, who would be stupid enough to give Nicolas Cage a script with absolutely no dialogue and say, hey, you should lead this movie, you know? But he was the biggest fan of Willy's Wonderland. He was the biggest fan of it from the start to the finish. Like, when he first read it, he was always in the corner of, I'm going to make this movie. It's the, you know, what you've written is special, and I'm going to defend it until, you know, either we make it the way it is, or we throw it in a fire. He was so on on board from the start. And that's a really special thing I think people should know about him, is like I was absolutely in a position where I was desperate and just trying anything I could to get noticed. And he didn't have to have my back. You know, he could have walked away anytime, but the guy was just definitely just stood by you like a best friend would and just protected it from beginning to end.
So Kevin Lewis, the director, how did he get involved? Did you know him beforehand?
Yeah, one of the producers of Willy's Wonderland knew Kevin from, I think they went to film school together a long time ago. Or no, they didn't go to film school together, but they became friends in the late 90s or done a project together in the late 90s. And we needed somebody who had experience with a multi-million dollar movie. And Kevin had done a lot of great films in the early 2000s that did not get what I personally think, that did not get the admiration that they deserved. And so when Kevin first read it, he got it immediately. And he and I were always like kind of in sync from the start. And what I noticed about him almost immediately was that his work ethic was something special. He's the first person there. He's the last person to leave. He cares about it more than anybody else. And that's why I knew Kevin being the director was the right thing from almost like the second I met him.
Were you on set a lot when they were filming the movie?
No, I was actually in Germany during most of the filming, but I got a lot of updates from Kevin and from Nick and from the people that were working on the film. I would be getting stuff all the time, so I knew that it was in good hands. You know, at some point, I say this about plays all the time. Like if you write a play or if you write a screenplay, people are going to take your work, and if they're the right people, they're going to elevate it. And that's what I noticed with Willy's Wonderland, is everybody that worked on that film took what I had done and brought it to a point of unbelievableness that I thought it could never hit. Like I watching the movie in its final version, I was just sitting there in awe, because I thought I was just going to be doing this thing in a garage fighting somebody in a bear suit, and all of a sudden it's there, it's on stage and somebody or on the screen and everybody's digging it. It's just like, if you find good people, they will elevate whatever you can do. And that's true in movies, but that's true in sports, and that's true in life in general. If you surround yourself with hardworking, excellent human beings, they're only going to make you look better.
Yeah, and people talk about a lot about Nicolas Cage, and rightfully so, but everyone in it's really good, the whole cast
is fantastic. You know, everybody really knocks it out of the park. The actor that plays Tex in it, Rick, he's just such a good Tex.
Kind of the villains besides the puppets are
yeah really good. Yeah, oh, the animatronics are excellent. The people that did all the stunts and all the puppeteering and the suit work, that's amazing. The actors are amazing. The teens are all great. Beth Grant is a fabulous villain. It's like we could go on and on for like an hour about how each one of them made their characters larger than life. That's the thing that I like about movies, is if they have characters that you can just picture in your head immediately. Like we can do that with comic books really easily, right? Like if I said Batman, you know who that is. If I say the Riddler, you know who that is. And that's kind of what we wanted to do with the Willy's Wonderland. If we say Tex or Sheriff Lund or the janitor or Ozzy Ostrich, you just immediately picture those people in your head.
Yeah. They said when you wrote it, you know, you were going to film it one area because, you know, you were going to do it yourself and everything. So when they did make the movie, did they film it in one location?
Yeah, I think that I'd have to say like probably 90% of Willy's Wonderland was all shot in a studio. And then, even like the roof scene was just done with like blue screen. So like the majority of that movie, it's amazing what they did, all took place in just a square studio space. And then there's the outdoor stuff and actually the outside of Willy's. But, you know, it was like 90% of it was all in that one area. And I think if you're an emerging filmmaker or somebody who's trying to get something off the ground, if you can reduce your cost by putting your film in just one location, it's really gonna entice people, because it's not a thing of like, oh, this is gonna cost so much money, we'll never be able to make it. If it's in one location, all your costs drop way down, and it's something that you can actually pull off and make. And that's really what happened with Willy's Wonderland.
That may be a weird question, but when you're writing a script with the main character doesn't have dialogue, what is that process like? Is it mostly, you know, his mannerisms? You actually write all these things out?
Yeah, I put in when I broke a lot of the rules to screenplays when I was writing it, because I would talk to the audience as myself. Like when you read the screenplay, I talk about like what the janitor is feeling and thinking. Like the janitor is cleaning up. I know, like what the scene from the movie that's easy to talk about is like the janitor cleans the whole bathroom and then gets distracted by the song. He walks outside and then he sees the door slammed to the bathroom. He goes back in and they're written on the wall, "It's your birthday," in blood. And I wrote, janitor sees that, gets really frustrated, grabs spray bottle. Like I put in there like what the janitor was actually feeling and thinking. And I was and talked to the audience as if like this is the way the janitor's thinking about stuff. And when I first gave that script out to some friends, they were like, "Hey, I don't know how this translates onto screen, because I can read it like a novel and I can understand it and I can sympathize with that character as we go along. But when you put it on screen, I don't know if it's going to come across." And that was always a big worry. But then getting Nick and with Kevin's direction, I think all of his emotions come across really well. So yeah, I put if you have a character, you don't have any dialogue, I think you can speak for him in the text for sure.
Tristan, do you have a question?
So you've sort of touched on your theater roots and mentioned having a very supportive uncle. And according to IMDb, you were born in California. So I'm wondering if you always had a career in the arts in mind.
Yeah, I think I always did. You know, I grew up in Lake Tahoe, and I grew up on the California side and was very active in all sorts of outdoor activities and sports and stuff like that. And I was making movies in high school using just, we've talked about it, the great camcorder, the great Sony camcorder of the 90s, where you could hit record and then hit stop and then flip it around and then hit record and hit stop. This is before like Final Cut Pro or iMovie or any of that kind of stuff. So I was always doing those films in high school and then showing them to whatever class I had that day. So if it was the English class, I'd wheel in like a box TV and show everybody these incredibly awful movies that I had made. And so then when I moved down to Los Angeles, I just kind of continued to do that. I branched into more plays and more theater just because it was something that I got into just a little bit more. But yes, I had always come from that background of I want to do stuff in the movies and I want to make movies and I want to tell stories.
What were some of the movies you were into before you got involved in making movies?
It was always whatever I could find at the Blockbuster or on the VOD download channels. Like one of my favorite things to do is find like cheesy horror movies. I was talking to a friend the other day about a movie called Bad Ben that Nigel Bock made that's like about this guy who he did it all with his cell phone. It's a really interesting film. It's like he had gotten the backstory is he had gotten a bunch of friends together to shoot a movie. All his friends bailed on him that day. And then he went and just did it himself. Like he just took his cell phone and just started doing this found footage movie. And it's very interesting, but it's also really funny. I love the kind of horror movies, especially like the 80s and 90s horror movies. And I've talked about like the movie Jack Frost, where this serial killer becomes a it's just freaking amazing, right? Mm-hmm. Like those are the kind of movies that I always love, because number one, they're interesting, they're funny, they're entertaining, they're scary, they don't overstay their welcome. It's something that it's the other thing that I like about it, and I think Willy's Wonderland did this well. It's like one of those movies that you get together with your friends, back when we could all get together with our friends and sit on a couch and just really just laugh our butts off watching. Like that was one of like that was those are the kind of movies that I adore the most, are the ones where you can have a group of people around and just be laughing. And then afterwards, talk about your favorite scene or talk about the funniest thing that happened or talk about like this person got killed. Then this person got killed and this guy goes to the grocery store to buy milk. Like what's going on? You know, that was always the absurdity of those films that I love the most.
Yeah. For me, the shower scene of Jack Frost.
Yeah. I mean, it's great.
Yeah. I also like that you said, don't overstay your welcome, too. I think I think that's a good good lesson for everyone who makes those kind of horror movies.
Yeah, I think like 80. I think ours ran about 85 minutes. You know, that's pretty good. Just you want to get in and get out and make everybody. It's like a roller coaster ride. Like, the longer the roller coaster ride goes on, the less fun it is. If you can just do a 2-minute ride and be done, then you want to go back and do another one. You know, it's like, but if that thing goes on and on and on, it eventually doesn't become fun anymore. Real quick question, like really a thing that just popped in my head. One time I won tickets to go to like the Halloween Horror Nights, and I got front of the line passes to all of them. And so the first one I'd go to, it was super scary and, you know, really fun. Then the second one, super scary and sort of fun. And then the third, you know, and the more you go, and especially not waiting in line, just going to the front of the line, by the time we got to the eighth one, it just wasn't as fun and I didn't have as good a time. And by that time, everybody was yelling at me for skipping ahead in the line and stuff. But it's like one of those things where you just want to be able to hit your audience with the good time and then get out, and just before everybody knows it, it's over.
Yeah. Did you have like a backstory for each of the puppets?
No, not really. I mean, I had like, I kind of had what you know, I knew that there needed to be enough that he could sufficiently fight them. And I knew that Willie had to be the big bad boss at the end. But we didn't really get into that much of like, besides Jerry Willis, the guy that owned Willy's Wonderland and was like the serial killer and, you know, did terrible stuff way back in the day. Besides that, I didn't have that too much of a backstory to him. You know, I kind of kept it light on that stuff too. It was really supposed to be just him fighting robots. And again, I think that this is another thing to think about with that script was I wrote that just as a passion project for myself, and I was doing it more to just give myself an acting role. And it's one of those things where you think like, how does he get away with all this kind of stuff, with the wave, with the hallway punch, with all this kind of crazy stuff that happens in Willy's Wonderland? Well, it's because like I wrote it, and then really the first person that ever saw the specialty or the uniqueness of it was Nicolas Cage, and he protected it. So that's how it went from like crazy idea to crazy movie. You know, it's like that doesn't really happen. And so I never put that much thought into a backstory. I never put that much thought into, well, for example, Siren Sarah. Siren denotes like a sea creature or a mermaid or something, but I was just looking for a rhymy name, so I named this Farah Siren Sarah. You know, I was like, that doesn't make any sense.
Nasty Neil. Well, yeah, I approve. The how about for the janitor? You know, I don't want you to give it away if you do have a backstory, but.
Yeah, well, as far as the janitor goes, one of the beautiful things about no one knowing anything about the janitor is that everybody can know everything about him because he can be your own character. So the janitor can be this person that is whatever you want him to be, you know? And I've heard a lot of people have different debates about this. Like some people say he's this and some people say he's that. I was talking to somebody who watched it with a group of friends over Discord or something, and they all talked about it and they all had different backgrounds of who this guy is and what he could be. And I think that is another thing that I didn't intend to happen, that was something very special that came out of it, was this character was created that everyone could relate to because they could put their own personal spin on who he is and what he does. And because I don't have a particular inclination to say what I think, and I know Nicolas Cage doesn't either, then everybody can always be right.
Yeah, I like that actually. Trista, do you have a question?
Do you plan to continue your acting career, or are you focusing primarily on writing now?
No, I hope to do both. I think the people that I admire the most are people like Ed Burns and people like Miranda July and people like Woody Allen and people that put themselves in their own thing. That's kind of like a model that I always wanted to emulate. Now, Nicolas Cage comes and steals my role, and I'll never forgive him for it. But besides that, you know, it is something that I want to continue to pursue and work on. And, you know, sometimes I'll try and get myself in there. And if I don't, then it'll be like Willy's Wonderland, where I just can sit back and cheerlead, really.
Will we ever see any more of the janitor?
I think that we will probably see more of the janitor. I think that he is becoming a character that everybody has kind of roots for. I'd say that he is an antidote to the acid. And I think that while we may see him again in other adventures against the evil animatronics, he can also take on some other supernatural villains. And I think that would be kind of fun to see. It would be cool to put him in a situation where he has to take on someone of a different ilk, someone of a different kind of evil background. You know, I think that would be something fantastic. I think that the people that put out Willy's Wonderland and brought the movie to life are all at currently just continuing to just try and make as much of the movie as possible right now. And then once things start to settle down, we'll discuss where the character can go in the future.
Interesting you said that, because a friend of the show, David Howard Thornton, who plays Art the Clown in Terrifier films, said that he would like to see Art the Clown versus the janitor.
Oh, yeah. Good date. You know, that would be a good – see, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, I would love to see him take on all those kind of villains. It would be so much fun. It would there's a lot of clearances and stuff that have to happen, but there's got to be some fan fiction out there that can skirt those lines and do that stuff. So if anybody does that, please have fun with the character.
Yeah. Along those lines, it's you see a lot of people talking about the movie. What's the feedback been?
I think the feedback has been mostly positive. That from just the fans and the community and just your average everyday moviegoer. I try to – that's the stuff that I pay attention to more. Like I'll look at the reviews on the VOD downloads of the people that purchased it and watched it. And I look at those reviews and like five – you know, a lot of them are like 4.5 stars, 5 stars. And I think on Amazon right now, just the VOD download, it was like 4.4 stars out of like 700, 800 reviews. Like that's what I really like. And you know, it's not everybody's cup of tea, especially critically. There's going to be people that just absolutely do not understand it or would never understand it, or it's really not their thing, and that's totally okay. You know, I get that too, because there's movies that are just absolutely brilliant that I just go, not really my thing, you know. But I think the response, especially from the community that gets most excited about that stuff, has been really excited. So that kind of makes me happy. I think that you know, 9 out of 10 people in that community and our community are extremely excited about it, and that's kind of what I was going for. So that does really make my day.
Yeah, I saw the shirts were sold out, the Willy's Wonderland shirts.
Totally. I think that we put them up online for sale, and Thursday night when the movie first released overseas and then made its way over to the East Coast and West Coast, they were sold out like Thursday night, and now we've got them on back order. And hey, I was just wearing mine to the Costco, you know. I love the thing.
Yeah, I was going to get one actually, but
we'll get you one. We'll get you one. No worries.
Very cool. Tristan, do you have a question?
Yeah, are you working on anything else that you can talk about?
Yeah, the stuff that I'm working on right now is kind of in the same vein as Willy's Wonderland. And what I mean by that is it's kind of spooky fun and kind of absurdly fun. Let's see, I got a book called Subway Dwellers versus Barnyard Oddities that's we're looking for a home right now. That's like totally right in the vein of Willy's Wonderland. It's, you know, kind of superheroes versus evil creatures that are trying to take over the universe. It's the craziest title I could think of. I got a treasure hunt in a haunted house that's really fun, and we're just kind of working on a home for that one too. And one of the things I told you, I started working on this in 2012, and then I started writing screenplays, so I had a good quiver of stories and screenplays and things like that to draw from, so that when this opportunity presented itself, I could have more stuff ready to go and just wasn't caught like a deer in the headlights. So absolutely, I'm working on it extremely hard. I can say that I am meeting with some really cool comic book companies in the next week to try and get something else off the ground. So good stuff coming.
Very good. Where can people follow you online? Do you have a website, or are you on social
media? Yeah, I am on social media, so you can hit me up at my Twitter, which is GoParsons, GoParsons, at GoParsons. That's on Twitter. And it's the same exact handle on Instagram, at GoParsons. And feel free, if you have questions or if you follow and want to, you know, ask something that I haven't answered previously, please go ahead. I kind of get overwhelmed at some point, so if I don't get back to you, just know that's just I'm a little bit overwhelmed at the moment, but I try. If you've taken the time to watch the movie and are supporting it, then I always try and take the time to get back to you.
Yeah. And one last thing I want to ask is how did the pandemic affect how the movie was going to be released?
Yeah, that's a great question. So here's the wild thing is, like, we had the movie got greenlit coincidentally on October 31st, 2019. The movie had to shoot February 1st, 2020. So we only had 3 months to get all the stuff ready, which was like an amazing feat that everybody was able to pull off. Then we shoot the movie from February 1st to March 1st. If we had been at all delayed, we would have been hit by the pandemic and shut down. And who knows if the movie ever gets greenlit to be finished. Mm-hmm. So then we had always had the intention of releasing it around October 2020 before Halloween. But the pandemic slows everything down as far as post-production goes, too, because editors can't be in the room with each other. Producers can't be in the room with each other. People that things that are done in a group setting have to be done individually, and it slows everything down. So we did not get anywhere close to that October release date. However, I think the big bonus was that because it was delayed and because a lot of theaters shut down and movies that had huge budgets had to move deeper into 2021. It left this opening for us in February where we could stream it just to everybody's home over that Valentine's Day weekend and just make it easy for somebody that wants to watch something new, have a good time, kind of forget their problems for the past year, could watch it. So while the pandemic has been absolutely horrible, especially to me and to you know, millions of other people, I think it worked out really well just from a marketing of the movie, because it gave us an opportunity to kind of showcase our film without any competition in that particular genre.
Yeah. And honestly, I think that is important, to have entertainment out there for people you know, during this time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really just a fun thing to watch.
Yeah, yeah. It was always supposed to be like the plays I was telling you guys about. It was supposed to be something where you could go, have a good time, scream, yell, shadow box, do all the fun things, you know, and then talk about it with your friends later and then just think, hey, that was a roller coaster ride. That was really fun.
Yeah. Oh, I also want to ask, what did you think of the finished look of the puppets themselves, of the robots?
They were just beyond expectation. You know, they were really, really, really good. One of the things Kevin and I had always discussed almost from day one was if the animatronics and the robots do not look fantastic, then the movie is not going to be, it doesn't matter how good Nicolas Cage is, doesn't matter how good ever all the actors and stuff are, doesn't matter if the sets look, if it looks like a guy in a mascot suit wearing, when you see his shirt hanging out, it's just not, it's never going to play. It's never going to work. So the detailing and the craftsmanship that went into creating those, and then the puppeteering and the stunt work that came in bringing them to life, was beyond expectation. I think they absolutely, for the budget that we had, knocked it so far out of the park it went into orbit.
AJ Zyla, there's a lot of people on Facebook when I mentioned you were coming on. AJ Zyla just wanted to ask, did you have a bad experience at a Chuck E. Cheese?
I went to this place called Boomtown, which is on the outskirts of Reno, Nevada. And Boomtown was a family fun center and an entertainment center. And I always went there when I was a kid. Although the experiences were never bad. But they did have the kind of animatronic robots, and they had like the fun motion theater seats that would jerk you around left and right like that. And they had the mini golf. And so the Willy's Wonderland was very much crafted based on Boomtown in Nevada. And I set the script, and even though we shot it in Georgia, the script is supposed to be set in the middle of nowhere, Nevada.
All right. Very cool. Tris, do you have a last question?
I believe that the title had evolved from Wally's Wonderland to Willy's Wonderland. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was a thing that I called it Wally's Wonderland. And then as we moved into production of the film, there are clearances and legal hurdles you have to jump through. And for some reason that Wally's Wonderland, maybe it was because of National Lampoon's Wally World or something like that, it brought up just some red tape. And so as I talked about earlier, with the time that we had to get everything made to get ready to shoot, we didn't really have time to fight anything. So we decided just to change a vowel and make it Willy's Wonderland. And so Wally became Willy, and now Willy will forever be etched into movie history.
Yeah. I like Willy. It works.
Yeah, no, totally. When I first heard it, it always sounded weird. It'd be like your child changing their name or something, but like you get used to it after a while.
Yeah, I understand. Well, it's been great. I'm sure, enjoy talking with you.
Hey, I enjoyed being here. Thank you guys so much. And I appreciate everybody that's listening right now. Just know if you've seen the film, that, like, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Thank you for supporting it. And thank you for digging it and all that kind of stuff. I'm just a hardworking, just regular human being who wanted to get something on screen, and it happened, and I feel very blessed. So thank you, everybody. And thank you, Neil. Thank you, Trista.
Very cool.
Thanks.
Take care.
From ancient terrors to the search for modern day conspiracies, The Tomb of Nick Cage is the new sound in horror rock. Uncover the mystery of old world horror for the new world order on iTunes, Amazon, and more.
Ripley, we should have listened.
The Tomb of Nick Cage.
They come at night! Mostly! They come at night! Mostly! They come at night! Mostly! They come at night! Mostly!
Find out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Tomb of Nick Cage.
They come at night!